The broadcast is now starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
It's a true pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in New York. Elliot Turner is a co-founder and managing director at RGA Investment Advisors. RGA runs a long-term, low-turnover GARP strategy seeking out global opportunities. Before RGA, Elliot managed portfolios at Austin Weston Asset Management, Chimera Securities, and T3 Capital. He holds a BA from Emory University, where he double majored in political science and philosophy, and also a JD from Brooklyn Law School. Elliot has shared his wisdom and ideas with our members in the past. Perhaps my favorite was Elliot's presentation on Twitter at Wide Moat Investing Summit 2017, when Twitter traded at an enterprise value of only about $10 billion. We are truly grateful that Elliot has chosen this opportunity to be with us again. So on behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a warm welcome back to you, Elliot. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, John. Really appreciate you having me again. I learned so much from the community, and I like trying to do my part to give a little back, but I get so much more out than I put in. So thank you again for all the hard work you put into making this happen. Happy New Year to everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in. To give a sense of our long-term orientation, when this presentation's done, when I present PayPal and Roku here, I'll have presented 7 ideas at Manual of Ideas conferences since 2015. Collectively, those ideas add up to just shy of half of our portfolio. So we haven't sold a single share of those 7 ideas. And in fact, we own more of most of them than at the time of the presentation. If any of you guys want to reach me, here's some of my contact information. And I'll go to the disclosure slide. We do own shares in PayPal and Roku, the 2 stocks that I'll be talking about today. So just want to put that out there. And this is a little background on our firm. We have a GARP bias, and like I was saying, the low turnover. So I first presented PayPal at the Wide Moat Summit in 2015, and while I've always tried to present new ideas, I felt a strong impulse to go back to the well on this one. This is the Best Ideas Conference after all, and this is my very best idea, and it's our largest position. When John asked me to present, I knew right away PayPal was going to be it, but then markets got really volatile and prices came in a lot in December. Roku was a stock I followed with interest, but it became a best idea during the month of December. So I'm using this Kant quote for the second time in a presentation. It's what I used to preface the PayPal section of my eBay presentation from the Wide Moat Summit in 2015, and I like it here with respect to both companies. For PayPal, they formerly were a means to an end within eBay, and that was the premise with which I used the quote. That end within PayPal, that means within eBay, was driving volume on the eBay platform. It wasn't about PayPal itself as a payments platform. Today, they're finally treated as an end, and they have a core mission and a mandate to fulfill it. For Roku, they're competing against a bunch of players whose TV strategy is secondary to their own essence. So like Amazon's a big one. Meanwhile, at Roku, connected TV is their DNA, and that very fact alone I find advantageous. So I felt this quote was pretty fitting for both of them. So PayPal and Roku in the same presentation, I think, makes a little sense. Even though both ideas were inspired independently of one another, they share some common traits that support their growth and differentiate their offerings against competition. They each have improving unit economics driven by accelerating engagement. Engagement's a word that I'm going to use several times in the presentation. And one of the things I really like is both have a really big addressable market to sell into. They have secular tailwinds that are driving both growth in their actual addressable markets and share that they're capturing there. And one of the things that differentiates both of these compared to their competitors is that each is an open ecosystem, so they partner with many players on both sides of their respective industries. Customers have choice when they engage with these brands, and there's a really smooth user experience. But we'll talk about with PayPal why that wasn't always necessarily the case. And then there's a virtuous cycle that connects all of the above. So let's jump right in with PayPal. The pictures at the bottom of this slide are from my slide deck in the 2015 presentation. After more than 3 years of independence now, PayPal has forged a unique identity. Dan Schulman, the CEO, he started just before separation, has been the visionary driving the wheel. He has a unique background in both mobile and payments, so he was really the perfect choice to run the company. The Economist recently called Schulman a refounder for how he has uniquely reformulated and repositioned PayPal as a fresh new company, almost as if it was founded again from scratch, starting at the point of split from eBay. The one constant that PayPal has always enjoyed, which Schulman recognized early on, and something that really differentiates PayPal from the other payment competitors, is that PayPal is a two-sided network with a direct relationship on both sides. So PayPal owns the customer relationship in a way that makes even Visa and MasterCard envious. Central to Schulman's strategy has been empowering consumer choices. Choice is a word you'll hear a lot when you learn about PayPal nowadays, and an emphasis on partnership with the many players in the payments ecosystem. So PayPal had a central problem as part of eBay that it had to attack. The user experience had been really clunky. The tech stack suffered from serious code debt. Technologically speaking, it was hardly a platform. It wasn't scalable and it wasn't open. The tech reformation started with the acquisition of Braintree, and Bill Reddy's been really instrumental. He's now COO of all of PayPal in driving this initiative. Without the technological improvement, the many partnerships would have been much tougher to forge. Alongside the code debt, PayPal had taken an antagonistic stance towards the credit card networks by steering payments to ACH, which are higher margin for PayPal, but problematic in the eyes of the networks. Charlie Scharf, then CEO of Visa, called PayPal a frenemy and threatened to go nuclear. Scharf recognized the risk to Visa itself by PayPal owning the customer relationship and having a degree of power in influencing how consumers behave. So PayPal effectively was making some volume that could have gone to Visa and MasterCard go elsewhere. It wasn't easy, but Schulman plowed ahead with his vision in an attempt to change this. Visa opened the floodgates for partnership throughout the payment landscape once it was done, and we can see both a timeline and a geographic distribution of those partnerships at the bottom of this slide. So partnership was something that Schulman hung his hat on, but it wasn't always perceived very well by the investment community. As soon as Schulman was able to turn Visa from frenemy to partner, the stock suffered its worst day as a public company. The investment community had quickly pivoted their concern from viewing Visa as the foremost threat to fearing what take rate would look like. It became an obsession. This just so turned out to result in my first time quote in the Wall Street Journal. While everyone was getting bearish on PayPal, I was pounding the table that the Visa relationship would be an important driver of improving engagement down the line, and that engagement itself would be more deterministic to the company's future worth than take rate. Take note of the date on this article, because it appeared in July 2016. So this fear about take rate is something we still hear all the time today, but it's not new. So the foremost concern arising out of the Visa deal was the high margin ACH volume on PayPal would shift to lower margin credit card transactions, and in the process that would squeeze PayPal's transaction level margin. What PayPal made clear only after the fact, so they talked about it a little bit, but after the fact it became really clear in their communication that ahead of pursuing this partnership path and ahead of forging the deal with Visa, the company tested out what choice would look like on the consumer side to analyze and project exactly how funding selections would change and to really get a good idea of what their margin would look like. As a result, the company had a thesis on exactly what the future funding mix would look like, and they had a thesis on engagement alongside it. Importantly, the obsession with take rate ignores the history of the payment industry. In effect, the entire industry's history is about shrinking take rates. So if we look at American Express and Visa's historical take rate equivalent, the trend is obvious. Take rate trends lower over time. If this is true, then how do the platforms make up for it? The answer is that as take rates decline, these platforms are able to increase scale on both the merchant and consumer side, and consumers engage with the platform with ever more frequency. This is a compounding force on the economics of the business. These are two-sided networks after all. So if you look at these take rates, you know, one might ask, could you invest in American Express in 1960 knowing what take rate would do from then on, even though Visa wasn't public, would you theoretically invest in Visa in 1980, knowing what would happen with take rate? I mean, knowing what these companies have done and what their valuations are today versus way back then, the answer is pretty obvious. Yeah, it's pretty fantastic. So there were certain specific beneficiaries of the shift towards choice and towards partnership. Account growth was one of the really early obvious beneficiaries. Account growth is influenced both by bringing in new users, so that's one angle, and by making sure that new and existing users don't churn off once they start. PayPal had been on the receiving end of considerable frustration from customers who found it too hard to select their preferred credit card as a default option. These people often gave up on the platform, becoming a headwind to net user growth. With choice enabled by partnership, that all changed. On the chart here, you can see pretty clearly with the dotted line how account growth was trending down into the split in 2015. You can also see pretty clearly where active account growth jumped in 2016. This jump happened alongside and accelerated with choice. And really, I think this is the beginning of a period of higher sustained growth in active users. The experience has gotten so much better from a consumer perspective, and there are new partnerships, including with issuers, who are offering their own customers incentives funded by the issuers themselves to add credit cards to the PayPal wallet. There's also an emerging push to give liquidity to credit card rewards. PayPal's uniquely positioned to make this happen. So for example, JPMorgan Chase, through their Chase cards, and American Express are letting, it's launching pretty soon, but they're gonna begin letting their own users spend their reward points through the PayPal platform as they get them. This is helpful to Chase and American Express because these rewards are building up as a liability on the balance sheet and they want to increase the velocity of them. And PayPal's the one who's able to make it happen. So the other beneficiary of choice is engagement. Now, engagement looks like its growth slowed in 2016, but this is also a reflection of the rapid increase in new accounts. It takes time for the new accounts to rise to the level of engagement of existing users. It's habit forming, but not instantly so. Engagement has been pretty swiftly growing, all things considered, and growth and engagement reaccelerated this year. Since 2012, the typical user has gone from engaging PayPal less than twice a month to now more than three times a month, and you can expect this trend to continue. In some ways, you can simplify the entire thesis to the idea that so long as engagement is growing, the stock should go up. It's really that simple, and I've been thinking about it basically along those lines. Engagement is a reflection of the mindshare that PayPal has with its users. It's a direct reflection of the network effects in the business. When engagement's rising, users are expressing the fact that PayPal service is more valuable and useful to them. The more engaged the user base is, the more merchants want to accept PayPal on their sites. The more sites that accept PayPal, the more users can engage in a virtuous cycle. This is a crucial feedback loop within the two-sided network. User engagement also exposes the platform to peers who don't yet have accounts. Peer-to-peer payments and transfers are a crucial component in this strategy. When friends want to send money to one another and they don't have cash or the change necessary, they'll ask, do you have a PayPal account? And let's include Venmo in this, but leave it aside for now. If the one owed money really wants to get it, they have no choice but to download the app. So this has really been a good driver of new users. We've spoken about choice as a driver of engagement, but another one was the result of a big improvement in PayPal's tech stack. This was really empowered by the acquisition of Braintree. In addition, PayPal's fraud detection prowess was a crucial enabler of this technological advancement. What we're talking about here is the PayPal button and OneTouch. OneTouch makes it possible for users to log in once on a device and check out, as the name suggests, with just one touch forever after. So the first time you log in and enable it, every time you go to check out on the PayPal button, you could do so with one touch forever after. One touch combined with the PayPal checkout button has become central to the company's ethos. The company's leadership has literally started defining itself as selling conversion to merchants. PayPal can seize this high ground because its conversion rate is nearly 90%. Compared to 50% or less for other competitors. As a result, OneTouch and the PayPal button have been a big success in the merchant community for how it levels the playing field with Amazon's one-click checkout. The checkout button itself is the value PayPal delivers to merchants and supports a good chunk of the margin they earn. So these one-touch checkouts earn a much higher margin than your typical checkout over any other kind of PayPal transaction. So let's look at the unit economics of the business. Customer acquisition costs have fallen 2 years in a row and should continue to do so as the network effects driven by all of the above take hold. You can see this in the chart on the top right. The bottom right in the slide is really important. With all the obsession on take rate, there hasn't been enough creativity thinking about what PayPal looks like down the line. This shows what lifetime values of customers look like today and what they would look like were engagement to double from here. This is important in a few ways. First, there are already extremely engaged cohorts who are in fact this valuable to PayPal right now, and they're really large chunks of the user base. Second, with the existing trends in place, this is what the average user will look like within 5 to 7 years, the standard timeframes of DCF analysis. When you double the engagement, lifetime values go up 3.5x. So there's a multiplier at work here. That's some nice margin leverage. When I look through analyst reports, I see some of these assumptions supporting top line growth, but what I don't see is the analyst community buying into any operating leverage coming with it. Meanwhile, this past year, the company has been increasingly confident in forecasting operating margin leverage down the line. They've earned some trust with the funding mix results since the Visa acquisition, yet analysts are still a little reluctant to buy into the operating leverage thesis. So on this next slide, the top table is from my presentation in 2015 to highlight something specific here. At the time, I was told by many PayPal skeptics that my estimates were a little too aggressive. In reality, they weren't quite aggressive enough, and you could contrast that with the bottom table, which shows both the delivered results and what I'm forecasting from here. This is not to say the future will be as kind as the past, but it does, I think, show that when companies are executing really well, they tend to outdo what most of us expect. PayPal, importantly, has three revenue levers and one delever. The levers are new customer accounts, engagement, or what here is called transactions per customer account, and the dollars per transaction. The dollars per transaction is really interesting for how it protects us investors against inflation. When the cost of goods and services rises in the economy, PayPal actually generates more revenue and its cost base doesn't go up accordingly. Notice here that I assume dollars per transaction will rise at about the Fed's inflation target. The one revenue delever is the take rate. Adding it all up, the three levers minus the one delever result in a revenue growth rate right around 20% annualized for the next few years. If PayPal meets our expectations or even falls a little short, we think the stock can easily compound in the upper teens for years to come. We haven't spoken about one of the more exciting opportunities, which is Pay with Venmo going commercial. I'd rather think of that as gravy on top and not embed any expectations. eBay is also perceived as a big risk. Considering they opted to ditch PayPal for Adyen, but we are increasingly comfortable knowing that eBay growth has slowed dramatically in the last year, and merchants on eBay are clamoring for the PayPal button to remain a checkout option. Both eBay and PayPal's management teams have acknowledged this reality. eBay has no choice but to oblige, and word is they will keep PayPal central to the checkout experience and a big part for the foreseeable future. And clearly, One Touch has been a big part of that. One key driver of upside will come in the form of margin leverage. The analyst community is yet to buy into it, and we view that similarly to how the Visa Pact was greeted at the time, but eventually they'll come around. One other thing we didn't speak much about is the sale of the consumer credit portfolio to Synchrony. This resulted in cash proceeds of near $7 billion and an ongoing relationship where PayPal gets a little piece of the revenue from every bit of consumer credit on an ongoing basis that gets sold to Synchrony. This equipped the company with a cash stash to make acquisitions that fill strategic holes. So one such acquisition is iZettle for in-store payments and to fill a need in Europe. And this puts PayPal in competition with Square for in-store payments. And another one that I really like was Hyperwallet for marketplace payouts to merchants with a specialty in cross-border, which fits nicely with both the push to help marketplaces in all elements of payments, so both payments from consumers to merchants and from platforms to the merchants themselves. With our more ambitious margin assumptions, the DCF supports price targets at around $150, and this compares to analyst consensus estimates of $100. So, you know, obviously we're looking for a good degree of upside here. At the very least, the way we really think about PayPal is as a compounder, and think PayPal shares should compound at the rate of free cash flow growth at somewhere around 20% annualized or more for the next 5 years. So now shifting gears to Roku. For all those who subscribe to the idea that volatility is not risk, this one's for you. I know the year's early, but so far the stock has yet to have a range of less than 10% in any one day. I'm not really sure where it is today, but wouldn't be surprised if that's the case again. Leading up to this presentation, that made it slightly challenging to nail down any market cap or EV-based enterprise value-based metrics. That said, I think in many respects, the volatility is the market's way of reflecting just how wide the range of potential outcomes is here. And I think there's a pretty fat right tail that we'll be looking at. I like this chart here because it shows how the valuable 18 to 34-year-old cohort already watches twice the amount of video on connected TV compared to the average adult viewer. Just imagine what this will look like for the under 18 demographic. As time marches on, connected TV will take more and more share from every single cohort. A little history is helpful. I just want to put an idea out there. I have this weird infatuation with companies who have a great product that resonates with consumers, but don't necessarily have a profitable approach to it from day one. It takes them a long time to figure out how to make money along the way, and then eventually they figure it out. That's when I really like thinking about it as an investment. Anthony Wood, the founder of Roku, is a serial entrepreneur, and the name Roku suggests as much. It literally translates to the number 6 in Japanese, in honor of Roku being the 6th company Wood founded. Roku itself is also an appealing, unique-sounding name that in some circles has become synonymous with streaming web-based content on a TV. The money Wood used to bootstrap Roku was earned from the sale of a TV-attached box that was an early TiVo competitor called Replay TV. Wood learned a lot in the process of building a TV box. And since he bootstrapped much of the early history of Roku before having to take venture capital, before taking strategic investors, including the likes of Fox and Sky, Wood was able to maintain a high degree of ownership. So 25%, just shy of 25% of the outstanding shares today, and over 40% of the voting control. Roku's ties to streaming run deep. Just think how synonymous Netflix is with streaming itself. Interestingly, Wood was working at Netflix when he was really getting into developing what we now know as the Roku today. In fact, its first name was the Netflix player by Roku, and it was effectively owned as part of Netflix. Within Netflix, it was called Project Griffin, and Reed Hastings squashed the idea of launching a hardware box at the last minute, because he feared the company would be put in conflict with some of their licensing partners, like Apple, whose Apple TV was used for streaming Netflix, Sony, whose PlayStation was one of the early distribution channels for Netflix, Microsoft, whose Xbox was similarly an early distribution for Netflix. So Roku and the team, just before launch, were told that the box won't be going live, and they were spun back out into Wood's corporate Roku entity. And the rest, as they say, is history, both for Netflix and for Roku. So many people still think of Roku as a hardware company, because after all, they do sell hardware, and that hardware has their name on it. In reality, hardware sales are a means to drive placement of the platform for Roku. When a new user creates a Roku account, they add things like their telephone number and payment information. This stuff will be important when we talk about how data enhances their ROI for advertisers. Roku monetizes the platform in a few ways. One way is by taking a royalty on subscriptions commenced through the platform. So since Roku has payment credentials, someone who wants to subscribe to Netflix can do so fairly simply via Roku itself. Roku gets a cut of that user's monthly payments to Netflix so long as that subscription remains active. Roku also takes a royalty on purchases through apps on the Roku platform. So for example, if you buy Frozen on Amazon, like I did for my daughters, over your Roku device, Roku takes a cut at Amazon's expense. The second and more important way the platform is monetized is through ads. Roku has two main kinds of ads. First are audience building ads, where, for example, on the home screen, a channel like Showtime can buy space to try and get a viewer to watch a show like Homeland. Second, on a variety of apps within the Roku platform, including the Roku channel, which we'll talk more about later, Roku places ads within the viewable content, much like you see on linear TV, though at a much lower ad load. Once a household has an active account, the platform side has several levers to drive revenue growth. Every day, there's more content available to stream on the platform, and this makes the average household more and more likely to consume video on Roku. The ad side is still pretty new, both technologically and with big advertisers. As a result, some inventory continues to go unfulfilled. Over time, this will no longer be the case, between better tech and advertisers committing more budget. Heading into this year was the first year Roku sold inventory in industry upfronts. And the upfronts are a pretty big deal. They're competing with, or they're standing up there with pretty much every channel, like CBS, Fox, ABC, and selling some of their inventory in advance. And that should have a big effect in 2019. Also, Roku has some of the most unique inventory, and they're able to add a layer of data that's just not possible on linear TV. This has already resulted in average CPMs around $30. And in moments of scarcity, for example, with more live TV being streamed over Roku devices, there could be great room for even better rates down the line. So the platform's been driving growth on every KPI. Active accounts are growing swiftly with no deceleration, though we assume some in our forecast this year. ARPU's growing swiftly with some recent deceleration, though the base is still very low. We're only talking about $17 on a trailing 12-month basis per active user as of the third quarter. It should be seasonally high in the fourth quarter, so expecting something more. But this is pretty low compared to the other ad platforms. It's especially low when you consider the level of engagement and completion rate, which we'll talk about in a little. Hours streamed is the one chart in here where we don't include our forecast for 2019. It's really, really hard. It's growing very fast, so it makes it challenging, and there's no good way to do so. But similar to how we talked about engagement with PayPal earlier, hours streamed is growing at over 1.5 times the rate of active accounts. In other words, every single day, people are using their Roku devices to watch video content more than they were the day before. This has a powerful compounding effect on the demand for Roku devices and the top line the company is able to generate. So connected TV led by Roku boasts industry-leading completion rates. Viewers on Roku immerse in content more than they do on other video platforms. You can see this pretty clearly. Connected TV completion rates are clocking in at around 95%. Compared to tablets, the next best out there, those just reach 80%, and desktop is down in the 70s. So targeting helps completion in digital media compared to linear, but clearly there's something special about CTV beyond just targeting that gets meaningfully better completion rates. Why is completion so good? I think a big driver is how tasteful the Roku ad load is. Ads are 15 to 30 second spots with no pre-rolls, those really annoying things that lock you in before you get to watch the content you want, and at 1/4 the frequency of linear TV. They're also uniquely tailored, so that obviously helps. Roku has a big lead moving in this direction. When the rest of the industry was focused on selling subscriptions for streaming, Roku was focused on building an advertising platform. It's estimated that 87% of requests for CTV ads happen on Roku devices. Recognizing their lead and seeing their thesis play out, Roku took steps to put in place a data overlay to make it better for advertisers and provided advertisers with all the key metrics to judge attribution and know their ROI. When I talk to people in the industry, they say that Roku is as good, if not better, than everyone out there at sharing some of this data. And that's one of the biggest critiques that you hear about Facebook and Google, who, while boasting great ROIs, don't necessarily give the right metrics for attribution. They also don't enable third parties to attribute, they being Google and Facebook here. While Roku has signed on both Nielsen and Comscore and has worked with many partners to facilitate good attribution. As a result, test budgets at large advertisers are turning into real budgets that are always on. This is becoming a recurring expense at advertisers and a recurring revenue stream at Roku. So everyone online is obsessed with walled gardens. And for Facebook and Google, being a walled garden has enabled them to, in the face of pressure, not give in and give some attribution. So Roku's trying to be a little different on that front, though they are trying to be a walled garden. They prioritize the user experience first and foremost. So Roku's ad load, again, is 1/4 the industry average. And the ads are uniquely tailored to the user. One personal anecdote that I think is a great example of this tailoring is that I learned of a really cool adventure lake in Connecticut called Brownstone Exploration and Discovery through a Roku ad. I think this example is unique in two ways, because first, it fits the kind of thing I would do and is in my geography. And second, because of the targeting capabilities, Roku brings some advertisers into video who otherwise might not be able to do so. So the long tail can figure out what they want to target and go for it on this platform. That's a pretty effective way to grow the TAM compared to the linear share capture alone. So I talked about this a little above, but Scott Rosenberg, who runs the ad platform, neatly summarizes the advantages for advertisers here. In many respects, the best evidence that advertisers are getting ROI is that spending budgets on Roku keep surging. One more recent development is Roku's shift towards building a moat around their walled garden. Some publishers sell their own inventory on apps, like Hulu. So Roku hasn't monetized those ads other than unfilled inventory Hulu itself couldn't sell. Recently, Roku changed their terms of services to no longer let publishers access the IP address of the viewer. Without the IP address, a lot of crucial data like geolocation can't be accessed. In order to access this data for a publisher, Roku now must get paid, even on inventory it doesn't control. And the publishers have to go along with this. And they have to do so because Roku is how so many people watch their content today, and you can't go away from that. So the addressable market on the ad side is pretty big. Around $70 billion of ad spend is spent on TV alone in the US, just the US. So we're kind of leaving aside the international opportunity. Digital advertising is growing much quicker than advertising on linear TV, which isn't really growing at all, maybe even shrinking a little bit these days as some of that share moves to CTV. Ads on Roku have been growing much quicker than digital itself. While this sounds great, budgets have been slower to move to connected TV than hours viewed. Hours viewed have moved over far more quickly. Inevitably, budgets will follow the hours viewed. You know, it really begs the question, why won't all TV eventually be watched through a connected device? It's better for advertisers, it's better for users, the experience is just so much better all around. This opens up the potential for TV ad spend addressable market to actually go up, because when you think about it, the move from linear to CTV and the data overlay and the opportunity to target should greatly improve ROIs while also bringing more of those long tail advertisers like in Adventure Lake in Connecticut into the playing field. So those things aren't really captured by thinking about TAM in this way. Right now, there are two clear leaders emerging in CTV in the operating system market, Roku and Amazon. Google and Apple are also around, so Google's Chromecast capabilities are built into a lot of TVs, but their offering's really different. Roku has a big lead in advertising, but Amazon, and I think some news was breaking earlier today that it's official, though it was first leaked in October, Amazon's going to push ahead with an ad-supported offering of its own. So, I mean, obviously, while 87% of CTV ads today are on Roku, that doesn't really necessarily mean that that share will be as high going forward, though it'll continue to grow pretty nicely. And the second key addressable market to think about is the household side. So today, 1/3 of adults in the US are reachable on internet-connected devices for TV-type viewing, according to Nielsen. There are 126 million households in the US. 27 million households already have Roku. Some in that 27 million is international, but that's a much smaller piece, so we'll again leave that aside for now. You'll notice the red strike through the households number. So as I was preparing this presentation, Roku pre-announced their year-end 2018 active accounts at CES in Las Vegas. It was a little bittersweet because the stock surged and I have plenty of exposure, but I really wanted to present the stock from what was then an even better risk reward level. But even still, I love the opportunity today, and we'll get into the numbers shortly. It's also important to clarify that Roku speaks in terms of households. I've seen this misquoted in a few places. Their active accounts is not the number of unique users, nor is it the number of devices sold. More and more households are buying more than one Roku. So Roku's selling way more devices than they are 27 million. This has been one pillar supporting the growth in our stream per account, and it also serves to keep churn low and increase the value of its existing customer base. One interesting aside about the Roku stick and something that it's done, something that's changed what a household means for video viewing, is that people who love their Roku devices have started traveling with them when they go on vacation. So obviously every hotel or using Airbnbs and whatnot now have Wi-Fi capabilities. So you could bring your Roku, connect it to the Wi-Fi, have all your channels available there for you and watch TV exactly as you would at home. So this is something new and something interesting. And it's really easy because the stick is the size of a USB dongle. So you don't even have to take up any space in your carry-on. So competition is always a concern. And I mentioned Amazon. Amazon is a major competitor to just about everyone these days in just about every industry. So like last year I was presenting at Walgreens and Amazon was the elephant in the room, so to speak. And again, Google and Amazon and Apple also play in this area. I think Roku has a few advantages. It's the first mover here, so the existing scale is ahead of the competition, both in terms of the number of households that are there and in the amount of the amount of ads they serve. And I think the technology is superior. So I tried both the Fire Stick and the Roku side by side, and I think the Roku is a way better user experience. Getting back to my quote from Kant at the very beginning, CTV is not a means to an end for Roku. It's literally their essence. It's everything for the company. It's their very existence. So for the competition, CTV is one of many strategic initiatives that must compete for resources with other areas. And while they do have considerable resources to dedicate, it's one pillar in a multi-pronged strategy. For Roku, it's everything. And I've found that while even if you think back to Facebook in its very early days, everyone was worried that something like Google Plus could kill it. It's very different to have something be your end-all be-all than for something to be one other strategy. When it's your end-all be-all, you tend to be more creative. You tend to be more attuned to what developments could actually make a difference. And then one of the most important differentiators is that Roku is an open platform. So these other competitors that Roku has are also competitors with one another. And one problem that has arisen is, for example, YouTube has been off the Amazon Fire TV, and Amazon Prime has been off of Google's Chromecast offerings. Roku is the only platform where you could get everything, and Roku lets you access all the content you want. So just the other day, fears arose when Apple started stated that their movies would be available for viewing on Samsung devices, much as the Roku channel is, which we'll talk about in a little. But you know, people were worried that maybe this would be another prong of competition for Roku. And then just the next day, Anthony Wood suggested that perhaps, you know, he didn't say it explicitly, but he suggested that perhaps Apple would eventually appear on Roku devices as well. And if you ask me, I think that's inevitably going to happen. So if you want to have the maximum number of choice from a user's perspective, much like we talked about with PayPal, if you want choice, then Roku is the obvious choice for you. Roku's user experience is so much better than all the others. It's faster, higher quality, simpler to use. And then another thing that really helps is large retailers love selling Roku-powered TVs because they move well, they're high quality, and selling Roku helps beat Amazon in a key area. So if you're Walmart or Costco, two players that sell a whole lot of TVs, why would you ever want to help Amazon in any area? You're going to do what you can to empower Roku here, and they're putting their money where their mouth is. So Walmart had special promotions for Roku using Roku's colors featuring them, so much so that media analyst Rich Greenfield at BTIG thinks that Roku will inevitably be bought by Walmart. But I think you get the picture here. So TV manufacturers deserve their own slide for how they strengthen Roku's hand against competition. They're a key part of the Roku edge, and Roku plays a key role in empowering TV manufacturers. Roku's software is built to run on low-cost TVs, so the manufacturers themselves can get the same picture quality, which is really what we're after, inevitably, with cheaper hardware components. This is a big driver of Roku's appeal to manufacturers, a big driver of the appeal to retailers, and something customers love because you get a cheaper TV at the same quality. So Roku's hardware is increasingly a TV itself, though the company also sells streaming sticks. One in four TVs sold today are powered by Roku. The advantages the Roku OS offers manufacturers made most clear with the example of TCL. TCL rose from 24th in US TV market share just a few years ago to number three last year. The Washington Post Hardware Review recently called the Roku-powered TCL the best deal on a premium TV I've ever seen. And Roku was able to win these accolades despite costing less than half as much. So $600 for TCL Roku TV, $1,299 for the same Samsung at the same size. Why wouldn't a customer opt for the Roku? Roku could theoretically lower the price on its hardware, something Wood has mused about. They have about a 6% gross margin on the hardware side of things, which could go to zero or even negative given the platform value. But they have found market resonance with their price today. They're already cheaper than the competition, so there's no price pressure there. And the purchase price serves as a form of commitment from the purchaser. This commitment is similar to what it's like when someone becomes a Costco or Amazon Prime member. The psychological force behind commitment is a real phenomenon, and it's very strong. If this is a platform company, then why am I talking about the hardware so much here? I think it's because we're looking at a SaaS-like company, but you don't need to subscribe and you don't need to think about canceling. Switching costs are high. With a TV, you're putting screws into your wall and you're placing a heavy piece of equipment on it. As a result, Roku should have much lower churn than any comparable streaming company. I know people who subscribe to Netflix, binge watch their favorite show, and cancel within a month. You can't do that with Roku. The likelihood of churn goes down even more because of that. And a third, many houses are adding a second, even a third Roku device to their house. So this brings us to the Roku channel. The Roku channel was first launched in October 2017 and has become, and it's really come a long way since. It's already a top five viewed channel on Roku. At first, TRC was only available on Roku, but the company reached an agreement with Samsung to offer TRC on Samsung smart TVs. Roku then enabled web-based login to stream from a computer or tablet. And more recently, it's not available yet, but pretty soon you'll be able to stream TRC from the Roku mobile app. What's interesting is that these moves have untethered TRC from Roku itself, from Roku hardware itself. In doing so, Roku has created a way for people without a device to engage with what the company has to offer. They also have made it possible for those who already enjoy TRC on Roku to take it with them wherever they go. TRC has been a great platform for the company to experiment with ad formats and ways to apply machine learning for content suggestion to users. It's becoming increasingly a central hub to the entire Roku experience, and I've heard suggestions it will be the home screen kind of soon, maybe by the end of this year. It's also potentially becoming a modern aggregator and bundler of content. So just last week, Roku said they would make subscription channels like Showtime subscribable and payable through TRC. Users will get one simple monthly bill. So remember, billing information already is stored in every Roku account. Amazon has something similar, and they've done it to much success. And considering Roku has already done well driving subs for content providers, this has a good chance of succeeding here too, I think. The better TRC does overall in all of its initiatives, the better content Roku is able to get on the platform, and the better content on the platform, the more people want to watch TRC. So this is another virtuous cycle at work here. So this gets us to the unit economics. The hard part to figure out here is where ARPU will go over the coming years. As you can see, we expect decent growth in this number. The main driver will come from more hours watched, more share of those hours going to the Roku channel, which is monetized at higher rates than other channels, and better CPMs and more subscriptions sold through the platform. The platform itself is very capital lean, with most of the investment flowing through OpEx. R&D in particular. For the purposes of this study, I take half of R&D to be growth investment. In doing this, I'm looking to figure out two things. First, what's the actual cash flow the platform could generate per user? Were they not aggressively investing in growth? And just as an aside, this investment in growth, when they announced their intent to be EBITDA flat, break even next year, despite about $15 million of EBITDA this year, the stock really took a pummeling in the fourth quarter of last year. And so, you know, it was one of those times when investors were looking for companies not necessarily to drive as much top line, but to give growth. But needless to say, the second thing I'm looking for here is to get an idea of when incremental margins will inflect to actually be positive. And I think it's likely that they'll be EBITDA positive this year. The company suggested as much, though they want to be conservative in how they're approaching their financial guidance. If you'll see in year zero, we have a negative number here. That's customer acquisition costs. So customer acquisition cost is offset with the gross margin in our model on the player sales. This is how the company views it as a form of negative customer acquisition costs, and it's the way we approach valuing the business. We ascribe no value to the hardware revenue stream, don't really view it as a sum of the parts, as some analysts do, and instead focus on valuing just the platform. So this is where the hardware value comes into play. You'll notice that the IRRs here are really attractive. If you take our expectation for 37 million households by the end of 2019 and multiply it by the LTV for each user, you get $1.7 billion of expected value off of next year's user base. That's a nice baseline to think about because it presumes no growth and no retention of any users beyond year five. We don't have enough history to make clean assumptions about churn and customer lifespan, but thinking some of the points we made on the TVs earlier about how long the average TV lasts, you can get a ballpark sense. Many think that the average TV lasts 5 to 7 years at its first placement and often gets moved to the next. So using 5 years as a baseline for customer lifespan seems pretty fair in this situation. So what's the path to $1 billion in platform revenues? It'll take 40 million active accounts and an ARPU of $25. So remember, $17 plus was the number at the end of Q3 last year, and it'll be decently higher in Q4. Both these numbers, 40 million active accounts and $25 ARPU, are 50% growth from today's levels on each respective KPI. The question to me is not if, but when they reach these numbers. And it looks increasingly likely that that will happen in 2020. So what does $1 billion in platform sales look like for Roku? Using $1 billion, we can use a 10%, using $1 billion number, we can use 10% for the WAC and 4 and 5% respectively for growth to figure out what net margin the market is implying. At the beginning of this year, so just last week, the company was trading at 3x the 2020 expected platform sales. The math's a little different today, but not that far off. Using that 3x number, we can then think about the embedded expectations the stock price is handicapping against. For Roku to work well from here, you need any one of the following to happen. Greater than 40 million households, an ARPU over $25, a net margin above 20%, or terminal growth beyond 2020. For context on margins, even a company everyone looks at as struggling and a stock we own, like Twitter, has given the street a long-term 40 to 45% EBITDA margin target. So if you translate that to net at a 25% tax rate, you're looking at 30% net margins longer term. Now, the margin number is the one least likely to happen in the near term, so the company maintains its insistence on investing in growth. But we sure think it's really likely they hit these numbers put out by 2020 on households and ARPU. Meanwhile, the stock is suggesting that if any one of these numbers are checked off, we'll have a good investment on our hands. Since player sales don't really go towards the bottom line, the most relevant comparison between Roku and its peers is enterprise value to gross profit. Looking at a peer group, which includes large and small platforms, all with pretty good growth, it's clear that Roku stacks up favorably. All these numbers are consensus estimates from Bloomberg, and Roku has the highest expected growth rate, but below average EV to gross profit in every year. The discount gets steeper the farther you go out. Notably, while many growth stocks had a rough fourth quarter, the declines were met with declining analyst expectations. So that's what you'd expect to happen. But Roku's pummeling actually came alongside rising estimates. The extent of the decline was something I haven't really seen while expectations were moving upwards, but that just plays into our hands and is exactly why the opportunity exists today. The strategic value here is pretty big too. There are many potential interested acquirers in diverse related industries, ranging from Comcast to Walmart to Google to Disney. I'd never premise a thesis on an acquisition alone, but I think it's important to think about strategically what this asset means for the ecosystem. So if you think about something like Disney launching its own streaming platform, viewing Netflix as their ultimate competitor, something like Roku would be quite the strategic asset on several fronts. The obvious one is that Roku could enhance Disney's ability to distribute and generate subscriptions on their own services. But the less obvious is how Disney would be able to get data on user Netflix viewing habits. So Roku would essentially be a Trojan horse of sorts. And I find that to be an interesting scenario to think about. Comcast already has an existing relationship whereby customers can forego a set-top box and access Comcast channels through a Roku instead. They do charge a little for this, but it's less than half the price that a set-top box would cost. Plus Sky, which Comcast is acquiring, has an ownership stake in Roku already and a relationship with Roku for distribution of its content digitally in Europe. And I think it's just interesting to contrast Hulu with Roku. Disney has pegged Hulu with a $9.25 billion valuation recently. Hulu apparently ended 2018 with 25 million users. So we're in the same ballpark here. We don't know ARPU or churn at Hulu, though it's likely both are higher than at Roku. Hulu's burning money rather swiftly, spending over $2.5 billion in content alone per year. That's before R&D necessary to build a modern streaming service. Hulu's clearly far more expensive to run than something like Roku, which is capital lean. Hulu does compare favorably in that it earns almost five times the advertising revenue of Roku today. So in some ways, I like to view this more as helpful for how it provides a nice idea of where Roku can be than you know, holding something against Roku. So looking ahead, it's really hard forecasting a company growing so fast in such a dynamic industry, but it's interesting to think about where it can be. In laying out scenarios for what 2022 will look like, you can see that at the worst case in the bottom left, with a meaningful deceleration in ARPU and net new actives growth that I think they should be able to hit, especially on the ARPU side, pretty soon, Roku could end up with over $2 billion in platform revenues. This is going to be a high margin, capital lean, highly recurring revenue base. You know, the question begs, how much would you pay for it? At five times the lowest revenue estimate in this scenario over here, this would be a $10 billion market cap. That would be a 23% annualized return over the 4 years heading to 2022. Time will tell here, but there's room to fall short and end up with great results, just as there's room to excel and turn it into something truly special. I lean heavily towards something truly special happening with Roku here. So thank you all for listening. I'd love to hear any feedback. Maybe have a couple minutes for questions, though maybe I went a little long. Here's my contact information in case you want to reach out to me directly. And thank you so much to John again for giving me the opportunity to present live for my first time. So really excited about that, and thank you. Couldn't be happier.
Well, Elliot, thank you so much for such a fascinating presentation. I really enjoyed it. We are almost out of time, so I do want to encourage our members to follow up with you directly with their own thoughts or questions. Maybe just a question on Roku, kind of tying back to the beginning of your remarks where you mentioned that there hasn't been a day where the stock hasn't moved around 10% or more. And it's understandable to some extent why, because this really does have a very interesting future. I'm just wondering if there's any kind of a short thesis on it out there, or any vocal investors who are kind of disagreeing with the story.
Yeah, so one of the moves this past week was inspired by Citron. So Citron's played both sides of Roku. They've put out short hit pieces, and they've called it when the stock was in the 60s, and they've called it the future of streaming when the stock was in the mid 30s. And I think his sentiment changes with the wind. But just this week, he put out a tweet that was suggestive that he was shorted and then since rescinded it and said he's actually not shorted, just not long it anymore. But the short thesis that I've seen out there on Roku is that at the end of the day, they can't escape being a hardware company. The platform is going to have a hard time monetizing. Most of the hours viewed happen on Netflix, where they don't have any right to sell ads, and that the competition is going to come on pretty heavy from the likes of Amazon, Google, and Apple, and everyone who wants to get into this area. So, you know, I think I've covered some of the things that allay my fears on these fronts. But I think one of the points I'd really emphasize is that these devices are in people's homes already. And many of these homes, and the clearest evidence of it, are both the sales of the players themselves on the hardware side and the hours viewed. Many of these homes have more than one, more than two. My home has four Roku devices between two sticks and two TCL TVs powered by Roku. So, you know, the more placements you get in a home, like let's say you just replace one TV once you have that, you're not going to churn off Roku. You're not going to replace every single TV at once. You're going to replace maybe one and maybe move that other one to another room. So I think there's some things that really keep Roku sticky with its existing user base, and the competition for these devices is going to happen more around the margin.
All right, terrific. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but Elliot, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to have you once again and have you present both ideas, one of which I didn't know before. That's Roku, and I'm very glad that you brought it to our attention.
Not a problem. Glad to have done it. Thank you, John.
Goodbye for now.
Take care.